Evening, everyone. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Passes her love on to everybody. It's a smaller group. I thought we could have a little bit more informal time with each other tonight. It was way back. I was thinking about. I really wasn't thinking about it. Just a list started to form in my head. The biggest of list in terms of the trips to India. So I came up with several items, and then Carla came up with a couple of others, which ended up to be a top 10 list. So the first one was the biggest blessing, Swami Satchidananda. From the entire trip. What wonderful blessings flowed from this great God-man. Of course, his body has gone through some difficulty. He's had a severe stroke. He has difficulty being able to walk mostly. He's in a wheelchair. He has some difficulty, or has had some difficulty, with memory, with speech. But the love and the spiritual light that pours from him is just terrific. And I regard that the time that I spent with him as the biggest blessing. The biggest surprise, the river Ganga or the Ganges spiritual power. The number of occasions from Benares to Hardwar to Rishikesh and going up into the headwaters that Dev Prayag and Rudra Prayag, Karna Prayag. Just the feeling of spiritual power coming. It came as a surprise to me, because although Ganges has the reputation of being able to take away all one's sins, we really felt the purifying power of it. For instance, when we were at Pulchati Ashram, there's another river that flowed into the Ganges. We were right at the confluence of the two, right at Pulchati there. And the river that flowed into the Ganges is quite a bit warmer than the Ganges was. The Ganges was quite cool. There's a bathing pool there, and we took a bath there in the other river. And that felt refreshing, and it felt good. Then we went into the Ganges. And a dip into the Ganges, and there was an inner purifying power that happened as a result. So here was an example where we can compare them side by side, just feet apart from each other. And there was a noticeable difference, and that came as a very big surprise to me. Biggest challenge were the dark forces that we met at Dwara Hut. We had gone to Dwara Hut with anticipation of staying there for several months, actually. And while there, this encounter with this very dark power occurred during a meditation at Sri Yukteswar's Mahasamadhi Day, I believe. And his Mahasamadhi Day. And it was really something to move through that. And it was an interesting confirmation in a way that as we left the meditation site and have had this encounter with this darkness, the ashram dog, Jackie, who is a lovely soul, and we were best friends from the very first moment that we met. And Jackie took one look at me coming out of this meditation and started barking and would not quit barking. And as oftentimes animals, dogs and cats, are sensitive towards these dark astral powers, and was seeing and sensing what was at that point surrounding me and that I was having such great difficulty with. As we were walking back, we encountered another dog that I had made friends with over the last days, and it too started barking at me and would not quit until we disappeared behind a wall. So it's very interesting to have that happen, and that was our biggest challenge. The biggest delight in India, the biggest delight is, as always, the pure-hearted Indian people. Such love, such hospitality at Anandashram, but also as we travel to so many different places. Certainly there are the difficult people, and particularly when you're a Westerner and you're a traveler, you get approached by people because they know you're traveling and they try to take advantage of you and steer you in the wrong direction or overprice tickets and all of that. But all in all, the wonderful pure-heartedness of the Indian people is the biggest delight. The biggest pain, Indian roads and traffic, touts and noise. Touts are those people who try to get you to come and buy something from them. It's something much overpriced, and they can be quite insistent. It's difficult to imagine for somebody who's not experienced it just how India overwhelms the senses. The noise, the smells, the sounds, the heat, the humidity, everything hits you all at once. And travel in India is difficult. So that's the biggest pain. The biggest sight, both S-I-G-H-T and S-I-T-E, the biggest sight are the Himalayas. What magnificent grandeur. We have lovely mountains here in the northwest, of course. But the Himalayas stand out as a living presence, and wherever you look, for instance, when we were at Kusani, we had a 120-degree view of these snow-capped mountains. And Trishul, which is a large mountain standing in the center. Trishul Tri means three, of course, and it's the three prongs of Shiva's trident, and so it's considered Shiva's mountain, has a very living presence to it and is wonderful. And so that's the biggest sight. The biggest tender event. Have a disciple there, her name is Rama Mani, and she met a Westerner, and she's been communicating with me some time about that, and I knew that she would like to have something more happen in the relationship, but she wasn't sure, and she kind of satisfied herself with where it was, and we talked about detachment and not getting really overly attached. And so while I was there at Anandashram, Dr. Ken was there. He's an eye doctor from Kentucky. And Swamiji, I was sitting next to Swamiji, and he said that he wanted to speak to something privately with Ken, and so there's a group of us there, but inwardly I just drew back and just started chanting Ram Nam in my mind and cut my ears off. But while I did that, God told me, oh, they're talking about Ken getting married to Rama. And indeed, he was asking permission. And while we were there, we weren't able to attend because we were up in the north, but they were married at that time. And so that was a wonderful, tender event. 3 years ago when I was there, I very much felt that she should be married and that it would be a very good thing for her to get married. So I was absolutely thrilled that this event was happening for her. The biggest news while we were there, the president, Mo Sharif of Pakistan, came to India. 3 years ago when we were there, the two countries were busy exploding atomic bombs, both flexing their muscle, you might say, at each other, and very, very high tensions. By all accounts, Mo Sharif very much liked Prime Minister Singh of India. They got along well, and they're talking about the differences in Kashmir. India has a 1 million man army on the border of Kashmir alone. So it's been a very big source of tension. And as we know, these things can blow up into something very, very big. And so to see that progress there and to see these two men establish a personal relationship was very, very important. And that was the biggest news event. Carla's additions to that list is biggest statue. When we were at Hardwar, we saw a statue of Shiva that was at least 60 or 70 feet tall. Absolutely beautiful. Perfectly proportioned, perfectly done, beautiful face, everything. Absolutely dominated the sky when you were standing next to it. And was very inspiring to see. And the biggest fun. The biggest fun was the elephant ride that we took through the jungles at Corbett National Park. And it was an absolute thrill to get up on these one-story high elephants. And it was very much as I imagined it, the swaying, the gentle, very gentle swaying, much more gentle kind of movement than, say, riding a horse. And just the motion back and forth. And we went into the jungles. We were having to push branches and things out of our way with our feet and our hands because we were moving right through the trees. And it was a bird's eye view of all the jungles there, the birds, the different animals that were there. And it was fascinating to watch these huge animals. Here they were, carrying four people plus the mahout and a large saddle. And they would go down a very steep ravine, and just in the most gentle, kind of careful way, just taking one step forward and kind of feeling this way, okay, that's a good one. And then taking the next step, and of course they have elbows on all four legs, and taking these steps down, and then also going up the hills as well. Tremendous animals, and great patience, and a great sense of calm in being with them. Although we did see one that was in the business of chasing away some tigers. And he wasn't calm. He moved very quickly and with great intensity and cleared the field. And that was fascinating to see as well. And very thrilling, having no idea that five tigers and watching this elephant, thinking the elephant was walking into trap maybe. All he is doing is busy cleaning himself, giving himself a shower with his trunk, shooting water over himself, giving a drink, moving down the river a little bit more, and here was these five tigers all crouching, all circling around him, and suddenly he chased them all away. One of the tigers even swam across the Runganga River trying to get away. And he just stood there for about 5 minutes and asking, well, is there anybody else taking care of that business? So they're tremendous creatures, and we were very fascinated and felt very fortunate to have not only close contact with the ones that were tame, but also the ones that were in the wild. And watching these baby elephants, they're born the size of a large full-grown pig. That's their tiniest and less than a month old and running along underneath their mother and held inside the herd as they were moving around. Very cute, watching these little trunks and these little legs running along. So seeing all the diversity that there was to see there, and that was the biggest fun, was being able to ride these magnificent animals. Before going, I couldn't actually say why it is that God was prompting me to go. I just knew that He was calling me to go back to India once again. I knew a rough itinerary. I knew that we were to go to an ashram. And I also knew that we were to go up into Dwarahat and Babaji's cave and the northern regions of the Himalayas. I didn't know the purpose behind it, and I didn't know exactly what the routine would be. But it turned out even more differently than what I expected it to. When we the trip to see Swamiji in an ashram was just lovely, every moment of it. And we were received with so much love, and there were so many people who came, and many who wanted to have spiritual blessings and so on. And it was a magnificent time being there. When I asked Swamiji for his permission, I says, we only leave, and that's tradition in India, that when you come or you leave an ashram, you ask for permission. And so I said, we only leave with your permission. Whatever it is that you want, I will do. And he said, what I want, what I want is for you to stay indefinitely. My heart just split in two, and just very touching and very moving for me to hear him say that. And I also felt inside of myself that I would have to be leaving. And so he said that, and a little bit of time passed. He says, but you must go. You must go. I said, all right, Swamiji, but I will think about what you said indefinitely. So that night I was just communing with God. And this whole line of thinking came into my mind. Indefinitely means without definition. Without definition means with unlimited expanse. That I should be at the ashram in an unlimited way, without any reservation, in a universal kind of a way, with consciousness united with God consciousness and divine consciousness. That's the way that I should be Anandashram, the abode of bliss, as it is translated to be. And with that, I felt that's something that I can absolutely commit myself to be there without any reservation at all, without any limitation at all, to be there indefinitely. So the time came, and we departed, and on the train going north, and then up into the mountains. We had met a couple 3 years ago who are wealthy, some of the wealthiest people in India, and they had invited us to come and stay at their house at Dwarahat that they had built for visiting purposes and for devotees to come to. And so we had taken up residence there for some time. And then this experience with this dark force, I was sitting next to a man during the meditation for Sri Yukteswar's Mahasamadhi. And he was doing a strange breathing pattern. At first I thought maybe he was doing Kriya. And then it became clear to me he was not doing Kriya. what he was doing was a tantric practice. Now, tantric practice is oftentimes a practice that is used to gain powers. And it has a very dark side to it. There's something called the left-handed path. Right, of course, is always associated with good, with positive, with the light. The left is associated with darkness, with powers, with egocentrism, and selfish greed and desire. This man was practicing from the left-handed side. And he was practicing these breathing and meditation techniques in order to gain power. And he had these dark forces that had gathered around him, and it is a result. When people focus on the dark side, that dark forces come in, and they feel that they are gaining something because they get some power from this. But they lose far more than anything that they gain because they begin to lose their soul. They lose the light that is within their own being. And as a result of that, they retard their own progress. They're not going toward the light. They're not going toward God. They're going away from it. And this individual is involved in this kind of practice. These dark forces that had gathered around this individual began to attack, so to speak, my own self and try to attach themselves to me. And this is what the dogs were barking at, was that they sensed that these dark forces were around me. And so it was a struggle for some time, and Carla was involved with it as well. And she had a real struggle with it. And we both clung on to God, we both clung on to the light. And as a result of that, the darkness was dissipated and completely eliminated out of this realm. But this was also a time when we were focusing on Sri Yukteswar. They had a large picture of him up in the front. And during this meditation time, and the time when I was struggling with these dark forces, I looked at Sri Yukteswar's picture. And his picture was alive to me. It moved. The eyes had depth of wisdom, and it was a living presence. And I asked him, I said, "What is happening here? Why is this happening here?" And he said, "It was for this purpose that you have come." What I didn't realize at that time was that the purpose being fulfilled for which I had come, then we were moved on. There was some construction that needed to be done at the house, and so we were informed of this and that we wouldn't be staying there for much longer. So God sent us on a different part of the journey. He took us down out of the mountains. And when we were coming down out of the mountains, I felt such great joy, such great relief. Part of it was the dissipation of these dark forces. Gradually, it took some time to recover from it completely. And also, the sense that I was going to meet some great being. And such joy welled up inside of me at the anticipation of this. At the time, I had thought something more along the lines of meeting some great saint. Some great realized master. And I thought, how wonderful to be able to do that. Of course, I had spent time with Swami Satchidananda. I had spent time with some other wonderful, wonderful souls. But this feeling that I had was something of an extraordinary nature. And what I didn't fully comprehend at the time was that it was not a person that I was to meet, but it was the River Ganges. And in India, the River Ganges is portrayed as a mother. Mother Ganges, Ganga Ma. And this presence, this spiritual force, this intelligence, this feeling that's associated with this river is something to really experience. Because when you do, you feel the inner purifying force that comes along with it. There is the story of Shiva, who went through a very difficult experience. And as a result of an encounter that he had with Brahma, he got angry and he cut off one of the heads of Brahma. So goes the story. Well, what he didn't intend at the time, and what happened to him, was that the head that he cut off of Brahma stuck to his hand. And he couldn't get rid of it. And he literally went all over creation trying to get rid of it, and nothing helped. And it disturbed him a great deal. He felt badly that he had done this act in the first place. And then to have this constant reminder with him was something that greatly disturbed his peace of mind. And so when he came to the river Ganges, for the first time, that reminder of that past sin, that head released from his hand and it floated away. And so these are the kind of stories that accompany the river Ganges. And as I was laying down and next to the Ganges and feeling the spiritual current flowing, it was like a river of energy that was flowing up the spine as the river was moving past me. And by taking a dip into the river. So it was a wonderful thing, wonderful thing. And this is what was being presaged when I felt that I was going to meet a great spiritual being as I came down out of the mountains. So we continued on up the Ganges, and we went to Rishikesh and Haridwar, two very holy sites and where many, many yogis have meditated and done their spiritual practice. They have wonderful ceremonies there where they have the waving of the arati lights. And again, we felt the blessings of this great river. We stayed at an ashram in a remote area called Pulchati Ashram. And again, this purifying force, and this really helped to completely wipe away this dark stain that we had collected when we were at Dwarahut and in that experience. And by physically going into the water, this energy was being washed away, and we both felt washed clean, both inside and outside. So it's really an amazing thing that God takes you through. You don't know before you go. You don't know what adventures He will take you for. So it's fascinating and it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's not always easy. In fact, you can almost be guaranteed that there will be difficulties. And so we shouldn't think that the spiritual path is just a walk in the roses, that there are thorns in those roses and they will prick us and we will have some blood and we will have some pain. But that shouldn't scare us away. Because what we get in return for treading this path and by encountering those difficulties and overcoming them, and overcome them you will, because you have the power of God residing within you. And when your mind is completely focused on the divine, not looking left nor right, but always focused on the divine and complete surrender to divine will, you are taken through any and all difficult experiences, dark experiences, for there is no greater power in this universe than the divine will. And where people make mistakes is where they get scared or they begin to wander off. And they don't keep their minds focused on the highest. And as a result of that, the mind is the guide, you see. And when you focus your mind in another direction, you follow it. And if you focus your mind away from God, then you will be drawn to those experiences. But as long as you keep your mind on the highest, on the most beautiful, on the light, on love, on all the good things of this world and of spirit, then you will be drawn through all these experiences, and you will enter completely and thoroughly into that realm of light. And there is no one or no thing that can interfere with that. And even if some dark force comes around you, your connection with that divine light, that divine intelligence and force, is complete. And you realize that you are an instrument of divine life. And so no lower force has any dominion over you. You may have to contend with it for a certain period of time because that is a role that God has given to you. And it is to help this world to be purified and uplifted and transformed into something greater and something better. But as long as you are focused on the highest, you have nothing to be afraid of, nothing whatsoever. This is my conviction because I have experienced it and I know it to be the truth. There have been things that have been given to me that have been difficult, it's true. But they have not been able to defeat me or deter me from the light. So as long as you hold on to that light, as long as your mind is fixed upon that light, then you will always be drawn to it. And it will give you the strength. It will give you the knowledge and the wisdom of how to handle these experiences when they come to you. And then you will also be an instrument of good in this world. And an instrument of God. One time I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, you know, just if you had a pen in your hand, and if the pen had its own idea of what to say and what words to write. So you're trying to write with the pen, but it writes other words, other things than you're trying to say. What a frustrating experience that would be. And that's what we are in the hand of God. We are that pen. And we have our own ideas. We have our own desires. We have our own notion of what to do. But when we completely surrender to the divine will, then we become that perfect writing instrument. And God is able to write upon the book of life exactly what He will through us. And you're not worried about, do you look higher than anyone else? Do you look better? Are you standing out in front or are you standing in the back? You are only focused on, am I completely surrendered to the hand that is writing with me? Do I feel the flow of life moving through me, creating some masterpiece in whatever way the divine will chooses? And when you live your life that way, you live in complete freedom. And joy and bliss, because there is nothing greater than to be an instrument of divine will. That is the highest that you can attain to, because the writer and the instrument of writing become one in the same, and they merge into a beautiful union of body and spirit, of mind and spirit, of soul and spirit. And you are that perfect instrument. And you will feel the power and the grace and the love and the joy and the everythingness of life. God does not take you out of life, but He puts you right in the middle of it for His own purpose. But you feel it. You know that you are that divine instrument. And so when God took me to India, I didn't know the purpose. I didn't need to know the purpose. I just knew that I must go. But the purpose revealed itself as the journey unfolded. And how perfect and how beautiful it has been. And upon returning, I don't know what God's purpose is for me now, other than to return, other than to take one day at a time, other than to feel the eternity of this moment, because it is beautiful and it is perfect just as it is. How much trouble we make for ourselves by always living in the future or in the past, and we rob ourselves of the eternity of this moment, because all infinity exists in this moment. But who feels it? Who knows it? Most people's minds are consumed with the past and the future. Why? Because they are avoiding eternity. It feels too large to them. It feels too powerful, too overwhelming. So there is an insistence to stay preoccupied with the past and with the future. But when you feel the divine presence here and now, you feel your eternal connection with the infinite here and now, then your soul expands. And you feel yourself to be forever one with that. And this is the absolute knowledge that comes to you through realization. And when that absolute knowledge is with you continuously, without a break, then you have really arrived at a high state of consciousness. And you know that, as Jesus said, I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. You know it. You realize it. You become that. And that is your eternal inheritance. It is the kingdom of heaven that is within you. And that becomes your all and all in all. Isn't that wonderful? And then you don't worry about what may happen in the future or what happened in the past. You know, one of the things that I've learned along the way is that realization doesn't change your past, of course. Your past is your past. What it changes is your perspective of the past. Because all of those things that you may have done wrong, all of those things that you may have done right, and in between, you now see in a context that they all helped you towards your realization of your true self. And that gives it a context that is absolutely positive and uplifting and true. And as a result of that, you lose any sense that of separation from even in the past, because now you realize that you are never ever truly separated. You are always marching toward that goal, whether you're conscious of it or not. And therefore you are always one with the infinite. And that changes your perspective and your understanding of all of your past experiences. So while the facts remain the same about your past, your feeling towards it, your understanding of it, changes completely. And any kind of sense of negative charge that you may have had about your past, it loses. And you realize that even those things that we call negative experiences eventually led to your realization. And so in that sense, they are necessary. It's not to say that you would choose doing that again, of course not. But you see how it played into the overall end goal, which is your own realization. And it frees you of your past. You become free of it. No longer bound. No longer bound. And that's the wonderful freedom that comes to you. Well, as usual, God surprised me. I had no idea of speaking of those things. That's what's come out. Are there any questions and thoughts? I also put out some picture postcards that we collected along the way, and we can look at those as well.
David, what are some, of course I want immediate tools, but things don't happen immediately, but ways when you're so pulled into the world to just, to find, you know, ways to get right back into spirit.
If from the beginning you can feel that you are this instrument, you are this pen of God that he's writing with, and you feel that the life force that's flowing through you is what allows you to walk, allows you to think, allows you to speak, you keep reminding yourself of that. And that God is all powerful, he is all good, he is all light. And you keep affirming that. And then you feel yourself connected with that and an instrument of that. Then, even in the midst of activity, you can feel like, I am not the doer. And it's that sense that I have to do this, and I have to make sure that this is right. There was a wonderful soul, and he continues to be a wonderful soul, but he's put up against a very difficult test at Ananda Swami. Was somebody who took care of our rooms and was cleaning them, and big smile, a lot of light coming from his face. They changed his duties and he started taking care of one of the older devotees there. The older devotee would get up at night time, and one time he fell down and he broke his arm, and somebody else had been looking after him. So this young man was put in charge of looking after him. He became more and more anxious about whether this older man would get up in the middle of the night and he would step over him and walk away and maybe hurt himself. He began to feel he was personally responsible for all of this. Suddenly he wasn't sleeping anymore because he was always on the alert. Will he get up? He was anxious about it. He was churning it over again and again in his mind. He lost perspective. He felt that he was so much the doer, and he felt so much on the hook about this, that if something happened to this other man, that he would be held responsible for it, perhaps by others, but certainly by himself. And he became so caught up in this thought, so little sleep over so many days and weeks, that eventually one night he just got up and he left without telling anybody. And he went away. And the reason that he did that was because he got caught up in the idea, I am the doer. Mm-hmm. So it will destroy us spiritually. And when I saw him this last time, he came to visit the ashram, no longer lives there. And his face was dull, his eyes were dull. There's kind of a darkness hanging around him. So it's a very difficult test, and he's a wonderful soul, but he didn't measure up in that sense. He lost his perspective. If we lose our perspective in the world like that, we spiritually die. So we have to make it in stark black and white terms. If I continue going down this path, I will inwardly, spiritually, lose my connection with God. I will die. I have to change this. I have to refocus my mind and realize that God is the doer inside of me. And that when I get filled with tension and when I get filled with anger and all the things that come along with being attached to things, I'm not that good of a servant to God. I'm not that good of a servant to those that I'm working with. And I make myself miserable and the people around me as well. So you put yourself in very black and white terms. I have to change my life. And when you do that and you determine in your mind, I have to allow and see God as the doer who operates through me, you feel such an immediate release and relief. And if you forget and you get caught up with the idea of the doer, you immediately feel miserable. You start getting anxious, you start driving faster, you get angry at other people because they're not driving faster, they're in your way, they're not doing what you want them to do, and you think, what am I doing here? I've lost perspective. So that's your reminder to back up then again, and then to feel as if God is the one who's operating through you. As you cultivate that, you'll feel more and more freedom. And when you lose that, you'll feel very miserable. And it's through the contrast between feeling the freedom, the inward freedom of being the instrument, and feeling miserable when you get caught up, that you really begin to get it. I don't want to live like that. That's my old self. I'm done with it. And you get very tough with yourself, and you get very strong-minded around it. It's not easy to change old habits, but it's possible. And then you even put the onus of that onto God. You say, you are responsible. I'll keep my mind on you, but you're responsible for making the change. Because even trying to make the change and then feeling like you're powerless to make the change, you're all caught up in yourself being the doer there. Mm-hmm. Even though the change you're trying to make is that you're not the doer. So you say, God, you're thinking this way through me. You're thinking that you are the doer through me. You must take that thought away from me, and you must become the doer. And then feel as whatever flows through you as being divine consciousness and divine will. As you practice that, it becomes that exactly. But to remind yourself, to keep yourself mindful of that, of course that's the trick, because it's an old habit. It's an old habit of the mind. It's something we have to get very tough with ourselves about. We have to get very clear. And when we get clear about it, it's amazing how quickly it can drop off. But there's a part of us who thrives on being the doer.
Mm-hmm. I've been using goofy tricks. Like every time I have an ache or a pain, I say it's God giving me a little shake, and it reminds me to think of God.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm. So I've always got a little ache or pain.
And if we allow everything to be a reminder like that, mm-hmm. then there's no place that we can turn that we're not being reminded of. And the main thing is we should feel the freedom when we let go of it. There's a load taken off of our shoulders. And who wants that load? Who wants that load? Mm-hmm. But you see, we're afraid we won't get what we want if we let go of it. And what we want, of course, is happiness and freedom. And that's exactly the opposite of what we get when we think we're the doer. Mm-hmm. We're not happy and we're not free. But what joy there is to feel that you are that divine instrument and perfect freedom. And so we're put into the world in order to test our mettle around that, in order to grow stronger in that. And we encounter some things, and sometimes we forget, and sometimes we blow it. But not to spend any time with that at all, just get right back on track again. Let it be a reminder, all right, I need to work harder at this. And just recognize that any slip like that is a lack of intensity in sadhana. And so we just need to pick that up. We need to work harder. That right remembrance. And so everything is a reminder to get back onto track again. The feeling of freedom is a reminder to get back on track. The feeling of slavery when we get caught up with the ego is also a reminder to get on track. So the one thing that Mother and Master and Papa and all the great masters have shared is their clarity on what the goal is and what the real purpose of life is. And our difficulty comes from we have some clarity on it, but we have some mixed motives. And those mixed motives are what takes us off track. We're really not sure that it's realization that will make us happy. We kind of think it might, but then, maybe if I dabble over here, then I'll get real happiness there. And it's really something to watch the ego and to watch how it really thinks, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if getting God realization will produce complete and thorough happiness for me. Now, if I make more money, maybe that'll make more happiness for me. Or if I have better friends, or if I have a bigger house, or if I have a new car. And it's not that we're prohibited from doing any of those things, of course. But it's that our emphasis that that will produce lasting happiness. Mm-hmm. And as we know, it just doesn't. It just doesn't. So that's where we get focused in the here and now. And that I am this living instrument. You say, God, you haven't picked a particularly glamorous way to use me as an instrument. But that's God's fault. You put it onto His shoulders. And how can the puny little human mind judge where you should be used? That your influence on one person or on another, or by completing some project, whoever, whatever that is, isn't just perfect and what is needed. And you don't have any real means to know how important that is. So you accept it, you surrender to it. All right. I don't completely understand how it is that you're using me, but I do feel that you are using me. I feel like I'm in harmony with your purpose.
I struggle with finding God, you know, God realization or thinking, how do I put this, thinking that's what I want. But then how can I get that if I don't have enough time to do my meditation, I have to take the time to
do
that.
You have 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You have 24 hours a day. What time are you supposed to not be thinking of God?
Well, I think of God all day long.
All right.
Okay, that's not the issue, but it's do I, you know, because on one hand it's you need to meditate more, and on the other hand you have to go do your daily duties that are put in front of you. We can't all just go to the Himalayas.
Why do you meditate more? What is the purpose in that?
I don't know. Just a thought that if you do that more, you're going to slow your mind down enough that you can allow God in more.
And if you were to slow your mind down and allow God in more, then what?
Then I would have better understanding of what. I wouldn't be so caught up in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be able to find that connection that I'm looking for or think I want to find.
And if you felt that connection more strongly, then what?
I'd still be less tied up in the world and less tied up in the world and less tied up in the world and more connected.
But, okay, less tied up in the world, but what would be happening on the positive side? That's
right.
Less tied up. But what would you be experiencing when you're less tied up with the world?
I'd have a lot more energy to put into connecting with God.
Mm-hmm. And what would you experience if you felt connected with God?
No, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I have a perception that it would be this joy and this bliss and this greatness, but I feel that every day. So
mm-hmm.
I feel that every day as I go about my duties.
And that is the mark of a karma yogi. But you completely feel freed of the world all through the day as you do that.
Mm. No.
I can answer that one. So that's where there are different branches of yoga. And there's
mm-hmm.
karma yoga, which is the yoga of action and service.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Raja Yoga, which is the yoga of meditation. And the Raja Yoga, or Kriya Yoga, or meditation, supports us in our Karma Yoga. So if you take some time out, and you quiet the mind, and you get more clearly connected, solidly connected, with the inner divine presence, then that will carry forward with you in your activities as you go. But unless you have a clear feeling of how that's going to benefit you, if it takes effort and it takes some cost to do it, but you have no clear idea of what the benefit is, why would you do it? You're not going to feel drawn to it.
Right.
You're going to say, the fun is out there,
uh-huh.
not here.
Uh-huh.
This is hard work. The fun is out there, so why would you do the hard work if the fun's out there? So you have to identify, where does that joy come from? When I'm in the midst of activity and I'm doing the things and I feel that joy, where does it come from inside of me? And what do you sense as I ask that question?
The joy comes, gosh, I want to say from accomplishment. What came to my mind was ego kinds of things. It's from accomplishing challenges.
Mm-hmm. Let's take it to this level. In your body, where do you feel that joy?
Well, I feel it right here.
In your heart center. Now, if you imagine just taking a little bit of time out of the day, and focusing on that heart center and expanding that sense of joy. Would that be a worthwhile thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
And if you were able to feel that joy, whether you're sitting alone by yourself or whether you're in activity with somebody else or with a whole crowd of people, would that be of beneficial nature?
Mm-hmm.
And so if that became the focus of your meditation, expanding and feeling that joy, being thoroughly anchored in that joy, night and day.
That would be
wonderful. Yes. That's what you're looking for. And when we disconnect that thought, disconnect and don't have that clear connection between our spiritual practice and the inward joy and bliss that can come as a result of our spiritual practice, then why would we do the spiritual practice?
No, and how can you, at one point, every time I get to where spiritually, or during the spiritual practice, I mean, I get to a new level of connection.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like you run, and then things start going haywire, and you're out here again.
Right.
And I think, wow, you know, because I mean, I've been doing, trying to do a spiritual journal. And
you see, we sense the power of it. Mm-hmm. We sense how big it is, and it feels overwhelming to us, and that we're going to, our fear is we're going to lose something. And that's why we begin to run from it. That's why we begin to not meditate. That's why we begin to get preoccupied with anything and everything except for our spiritual practice.
And that's at such an unconscious level, because that's not conscious, because, gosh, you want to be there.
Right. But suddenly you can feel like jumping up and just running from your meditation blanket, because you'd rather be almost anywhere than sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to stop and analyze, what is going on with me? Even though it's not conscious.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to realize there's a tug of war going on inside there.
So you just force yourself to do... I mean...
First you recognize what the dynamics are.
Mm-hmm.
You recognize why you're wanting to run.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just settle down and you breathe a little bit. You say, okay, I can't just hammer my way through this, but I can breathe my way through it. And so I'm just going to be present with that feeling of wanting to run, but I'm going to breathe with it. And I'm going to recognize that some part of me is absolutely terrified of entering into this much larger realm of consciousness. And what I know from my past spiritual practice is that when I enter into that larger realm of practice, I never regret it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like clockwork that every time I'm about ready to, I want to run.
Mm-hmm.
So that pattern is clear in your own mind, and you realize the pattern. And that recognition of the pattern gives you some patience and gives you an ability to hang in there and move through that resistance, that desire to run.
Yeah, no, I don't necessarily experience it as a desire to run. It just gets harder and harder to make myself sit down and do it.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, I know it is. It's just, you know, wait till the last 5 minutes of the evening. The morning's never a problem, but the last 5 minutes of the evening, and then...
But if
I need to go to bed tonight.
But if you thought that there was unlimited joy standing on the other side of that door,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't wait to get and sit on your meditation blanket.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an internal resistance and battle that's going on inside of you. And so rather than just leaving that on the unconscious level and saying, oh, I must be a bad devotee because I wait till the last 5 minutes and then I don't really want to do it, say, okay, I need to breathe my way through this. I need to work my way through it. I understand that there's an internal battle. And just try to make yourself go in early and meditate and see what a battle you're in for, if you want to just see how strong it is. So you recognize and acknowledge, all right, there's an internal battle going there. And I need to be... pound my way through it. I need to breathe my way through it. First of all, by recognizing what is going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And these kind of internal battles, they can last for days, for months, for years. And particularly when we leave them in the unconscious level. Oh, I didn't have any time to meditate today. Oh, I didn't have any time to meditate. I guess it's been 3 or 4 months since I've had any time to meditate. Well,
no,
something wrong with that picture. There's something more going on there.
Yeah, and
we really don't even want to acknowledge it to ourselves.
Yeah.
Just what the level of resistance is.
And I won't do that. I mean, I'll still go through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I understand.
For the most part, committed to going through the motions, but
yeah.
Then, you know, you just feel that detachment from what's happening,
right.
Not battling.
So then...
He's not just talking.
Yeah. I know.
So then you acknowledge that there's this resistance going on, and there's this battle going on, and you breathe through that.
Okay.
And you just breathe through it. And that takes you down into the next level. But that is predictable. Anytime you're going to enter into a deeper level of consciousness, the resistance will come in some way. Suddenly, you know, you just can't live without watching that television show. Or you just have to have that box of popcorn, you know, at night. Or whatever it is, you just got to do that, and everything else gets shoved to the side. And, you know, one time, as a counselor, I had to go from one part of the town, and I had to go into a central part of the town. The traffic was terrible, and I got there, and I was about 10 minutes late for an appointment, for a counseling appointment. And I told my client, I said, I'm really sorry, you know. And he says, well, let me put it this way: if you knew by being here on time that there'd be a $10,000 check waiting for you, and if you were not on time, the check's gone, would you have been here on time today? Said probably.
yeah, there's no way I'd.
If you knew that there was unlimited happiness and joy and spiritual wealth waiting for you on the other side of that meditation door, we'd be running for that.
I say that to myself sometimes, you know, it's there. What is it that, you know, and then of course you get into the dialogue, but you don't know what's there. You have to take that on faith and trust.
It is doubt, and it is even more than doubt. Mm-hmm. There is a real feeling of fear that comes up. Mm-hmm. And even at the time that we really seem to be making spiritual progress, we have some wonderful experience or something, mm-hmm. and we find ourselves running away from it. It seems crazy making. Until you understand that it's the very power and scope of that experience and the intuition of what lies beyond that that's even more that makes us feel afraid. Can I handle it? Mm-hmm. Will I like it? Will I like who I am if I step through that door? Mm-hmm. Will I be happy with that, or will I be caught into some vortex that I can't get out of? There's all kinds of fears that come up around that. And we just have to be willing to breathe our way through those fears. And to recognize, number one, that's a fear, that's resistance. I'm not running to get through that door. I seem to be running to go the opposite direction. You know, there's a man who was searching for God, and he searched all over the universe. Finally, he found the door to God. God written up there, and the door was there, and he started climbing up the steps to get to the door to God. And suddenly he thought to himself, but what if I go through the door? What will happen? I don't know. You know, maybe I'll be annihilated. Maybe I'll be turned to dust. Maybe I'll be a slave. Maybe who knows what. So he turned around, tiptoed away from the door, and he knew that he could go anywhere in the universe except back to that door. That's the way that we become.
Yes, I'm trying to get around the universe first.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because there's a fear. Because if I get through that door, I'll never get to experience any of it again.
And you know, there's a woman who was at the ashram, and Papa offered realization. He says, all right, whoever wants realization, come up now and you'll get it. You have to surrender yourself completely. She said, but I was just a college student, and I wanted to be a teacher. I didn't go forward, you know. As if being God realized means you can't be a teacher. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that was her mind. All of a sudden, I've lost choices. Rather than I've gained the universe, I've lost my choices, was the association that she had in her mind. And in one sense, that's true, in the sense that you have to surrender yourself completely.
And you have to trust what's going to happen.
That's right.
And that's fear.
And what you find out when you go through that door is that your choices have expanded to unlimited realms. And you haven't lost your freedom, you've gained your freedom. What Mother used to say, and it shocked me the first time I heard it in a way, and she said, gaining God realization does not mean I lost my free will. Every single moment, it is my free will to do God's will. But I have never for a single moment lost my free will. There's something in our minds that thinks we're going to lose out and we're going to become less than, or that, or completely annihilated and nothing.
But God puts that thought in my mind, and why doesn't He take it out?
You must take that to Him. With as much passion and energy as you possibly can. Why do you put that into my mind? You're calling me to you, and now you're putting this thought into my mind? You must make the thought
make
of...
Make up your mind,
that's
God.
Right. You must make the thought of attraction stronger than any other thing. And when you take that energy to Him, and you take that that focus of attention to Him, it clears the way. But we don't do that because we really want to stand on the edge and not jump in both feet.
But isn't that God trying to keep creation still going? I mean, isn't that why He's doing that to us?
But didn't He put the desire that is even stronger for your complete emancipation and freedom inside
you? Well, it's not right now, though. It's not stronger.
But if you say you must increase that desire for you, and the prayer that came to me at one time, because I felt no love at all for anyone or anything, you must make me love you. You must give the love in my heart for you. And it feels odd in one way to be asking God to give you love for Him more than for the world. And yet, where else will you get it from? So you take that to Him. You say, this is a very odd thing. On the one hand, you put this desire in me to gain realization, and on the other hand, you've given me mixed desires. And part of me wants to run away from you. You must make up your mind. And when you do that, you see, you're giving your whole self to Him. Give your dilemma to Him. Give that mixed mind to Him. And let Him straighten it out. But really give it to Him. Don't stand back and say, this is my dilemma, but not really give it to Him. Say, it's yours. And I don't want it. You resolve it. You have unlimited power. You have unlimited intelligence. You figure it out. You do it.
I'm tired.
And I'm letting go of it. It's yours. And God says, oh, thank God she finally let go of it. Now I can do something with it.
But I think I'm feeling contented with my
He's
lot.
He's thanking Himself. Well, if that's the truth, then you'll stay exactly where you're at. But of course, that's not the truth. You're not contented.
But it sure feels that way, huh, Jill?
A part of you wants to hold on to what you have, thinking that you'll lose something if you let go of it. But you look at the lives of Mother, of Master, of Papa, of Jesus, of Buddha, and you don't see non-personality. You don't see people who didn't live life. You see people who really lived life in a very full way, very dynamic way, very passionate way. So this notion that somehow we're going to lose out is a trick of the ego. So put the full onus onto God. You must straighten out my thinking. You must make me single-pointed in my desire. And when you do that, then I will come to you directly. As long as you give me mixed desires, I'm going nowhere. I'm dead in the water. That's your decision. That's your fault. But when you turn it over to Him, really turn it over to Him. Now you guide me. You think thoughts through me. You direct me through your will. You make it happen. And when you really open yourself in that way and you really surrender yourself, your life changes. your thinking patterns change. And it clears the way. God would much rather have us either hot or cold, but lukewarm, there's not much he can do with that. You heat it up. You increase this desire in me. A lot of people who have no desire around it. They're completely satisfied with the lives of the living. Great. Great. That's how God's operating inside of them. That's not how he's operating inside of us. We just can't rest easy with it. It's a dilemma that he's put in. It's a rock that he's put into our shoe. And we just can't seem to get rid of that rock. And we curse the rock. Later on, we bless it. As we say, if it wasn't for that rock, I just would have kept walking down the path as I was. I wouldn't have questioned anything. I wouldn't have thought about anything differently. You put that rock into my shoe. You caused me that discomfort. You wouldn't let me rest satisfied with myself. And thank God you didn't. Because it changed my life and it changed it for the better. So you see, we can actually pray for greater desire. You give me greater desire for you. You make yourself more desirable than the world makes itself desirable.
Oh, that doesn't work.
You've got to crank up the energy.
Yeah, I do. And sometimes you know the energy is real, and then other times it's the energy dissipated behind it.
Then you're honest with God, and you say, why are you being like this with me? You're being lethargic.
Yeah.
Do you think this is going to get me to you?
Because it isn't.
Because it isn't.
Yeah.
And then you put the full onus on God. You must do this. You must crank up the energy. You can't be lethargic like this. I don't mind a rest now and then, but this is more than just a rest. This is sitting on my haunches, and I'm getting glued to the earth here.
And loving it and having fun, huh?
Yeah. Nothing wrong with loving your life and having fun in it.
Yeah.
But to wander off mentally, and then eventually, which you see, one of the things that happens is everything is built in this way. We do something for a period of time and it begins to build a certain kind of consciousness and energy about it. So you're on your spiritual path and you're doing pretty good. And then you start to wander off a little bit, but you still feel pretty good. Yeah. Maybe I can drop all that meditation work stuff because I'm doing pretty good. I feel happy, I feel peaceful. And it takes time for what you have been working for and accumulated to begin to wear off. And then eventually you begin to feel worn out, you begin to feel lethargic, you begin to feel tired, you begin to feel disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think, oh, I gotta climb up that big hill again. And so you put on your climbing boots and you start to climb up that big hill again. But the mistake was thinking, oh, I can coast here. And I'm doing just fine coasting. It's because you're living on the accumulation of good effort that you've made before. It's like when you're exercising and you're really in the groove and you're eating the right things. And then you start eating the wrong things and you give up on the exercise. And for a while you do okay. And then you're kind of glued to the chair and you can't get up and you're tired all the time and, you know, yet you've accrued a certain amount of a positive good things there that carry on with you. It has a momentum that continues on. And so you can begin to fool yourself and say, it wasn't that important. I still feel good. And then you have to start that hard road again, getting back into shape again. So it's easy for us to fool ourselves and to live off of the momentum that we ourselves have built. And we can accrue that, we can live off of it for some time, but we then lose it. And those realized beings who get purified minds and vision, they realize they've got to stay on track through the whole thing. And if they do that, it takes them through everything and they come out on the other side. And they don't start coasting. They keep that intensity, they keep that direction, because they know that only real and lasting happiness comes through that.
Thinking that you're the doer, would that be the Barabbas with Jesus?
Barabbas. The robber.
Yeah. When he comes to Jesus and wants Jesus to fight the Romans.
The story is told with the Zeffirelli.
Yeah.
He tells that story in a particular way. Well, he's that Rajasic action. And he wants action. He wants deliberate intention created here. And Jesus is saying, you'll never get what you're looking for from the world. Even if you win that battle, ultimately, you're not going to get the real happiness and harmony and peace that you're looking for. The world will never offer that to you. And in that case, Barabbas doesn't agree with him. He said, I have to fight. And you're living in a fool's paradise if you think that not fighting for things in this world is how you get happiness. People fight for things, and you'll find many people who are of that opinion. You got to go out and you got to get it. You got to make it happen. And that's how you get happiness. But then you look at people who actually make things happen, and they gain a lot of wealth, they got a lot of prestige, they get a lot of power, and how many of them are happy? Usually the anxieties just continue on a new and higher level. And so Jesus was articulating to him that if he followed him, then the lion and the lamb would lie down together. The lamb is the sattvic nature, the lion is the rajasic nature. And the lion would lie down with the lamb. Two would go together. And that's when we feel that absolutely perfect peace of the self through activity. And here Barabbas was driven by passion, by anger, by desire to be on top. It's a very different motivation. The outward actions can look exactly the same. Jesus was quite strong when he went into the temple and he cleared out the money changers. He was being a warrior, a kshatriya, in that moment. But his direction in that, his passion in that, was completely subdued and surrendered to the will of God moving through him. And so it didn't fill him with that kind of desire to change the whole business of the temple and everything. His desire was on awakening God consciousness within people. Not just simply getting rid of the money changers. That was just a symptom of this larger disease that it had infested the temple and the people who manage the temple. It's like the person who said to me one time, and I've told this before, that, I used to do that Mother Teresa thing. She is a social worker, and I knew what she meant by that. She had dedicated herself, heart, mind, and soul to doing this work, and she used to do it that way. And I said, you start every day with 2 hours of prayer and meditation? Oh, no, I didn't do that part. I dedicated. Well, that was the core of the mother's strength and her direction. And her whole life was that spiritual center. And the reason this other lady was saying, I used to do it, is she burned herself out because she was doing it from an egotistic standpoint. And so she wasn't doing the Mother Teresa thing. She was doing an ego's imitation of the Mother Teresa thing. And so Barabbas thinks it's a human ego that will make progress, that will change this world. And for the spiritual person, the orientation is very different. God is the doer. And God's mysterious sometimes in the way that he directs us. Sometimes he directs us to help somebody. Sometimes he directs us to stand back. And it's like a dance. So we're constantly moving in and stepping back and moving over here, now over here. And some places where in the human mind we think, oh, well, I would like to give help here. No. Inwardly we get, no, not here. Okay, not here. And then someplace over here, I don't think this person is deserving. I'm not going to, no, you help. Okay. And when you're that sensitive instrument, when you're that perfect writing instrument, and you allow God to write in the book of life through you, then you go just according and exactly what he says to do and how much. And that's the difference between the ego saying, I can make something good happen here. And in divine consciousness, I'm surrendered to God's will. And if God wills it, he will ordain something good to happen. And we may never ever know as a human consciousness what that good is. Maybe one thing done unconsciously on our part that somehow affects somebody else that produces a wonderful change. So Barbas represents that egoistic desire to change the world with rajasic energy. And Jesus was representing that higher mind and was trying to draw Barabbas up to him. And Barabbas turned away. He said, not for me. And so people who are very worldly in their mind, they hear about surrender to God. Oh, you mean giving up. You mean not doing anything. You mean going sitting in a cave someplace and meditating, and that's not for me. That's how they think about what surrender is. Surrender is far more than that, of course, as we all know. But that's their interpretation of surrender. It's a complete misreading, but it's difficult to disabuse them of it. Heavenly Father,
Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence.
Of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit. I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace.
Peace.
Bless.
Bless.
Amen.
Amen.